Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the Van Leer Institute series on ideas. I'm Renee Garfinkel. Today we'll explore the most basic idea of all, what it means to be alive. Is the apple sitting on the kitchen table alive, or only the apple tree it came from? The question of what it means to be alive hangs over some of society's most charged conflicts. Whether a fertilized egg is a living person, for example, and when we ought to declare a person legally dead. We're honored to have as our guest today the award-winning science journalist Carl Zimmer, who writes the Origins column for the New York Times. Zimmer is a recipient of the Stephen Jay Gould Prize awarded by the Society for the Study of Evolution. In addition to his reporting, Zimmer is the author of 14 books about science. We'll talk about his latest book, Life's Edge, The Search for What It Means to Be Alive. Carl Zimmer, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
And Carl, Life's Edge deals with the challenge of distinguishing things that are alive from things that are not alive. Is the question primarily a scientific challenge or a philosophical question?
I would say, you know, it's both and more. Thinking about what it means to be alive or not alive is something that's just, it's also important in our ordinary existence. If you were to, be walking down the street and, you know, you see a rock, you wouldn't give it much thought and you'd walk past it. But if it started to move around, like, you know, maybe it was some kind of animal that you hadn't seen before, you'd probably jump. You know, you would probably instantly say like, whoa, this is something alive and I need to pay attention to it. It's the question of what is alive and what's not alive. You know, it's a medical question too. When do we declare somebody dead? There are a lot of cases where that is a straightforward thing, but there are cases where it's not. And those can become a subject of intense legal conflicts. Life is this question that's at the same time huge and scientific and intimate and personally profound.
Well, let's talk about the medical clinical setting for a moment. Brain death is usually accepted as defining, but it's not always a bright line, as we increasingly understand. Some recent research claimed to have EEG data showing brain activity returning to normal or close to normal after flatlining. Tell us a little about the case you report in the book, Jahi McMath.
Jahi McMath was a child who underwent some surgery, which unfortunately went awry. And she suffered from a lot of bleeding afterwards, and her heart stopped. And in the end, she suffered major brain damage because of a lack of oxygen to the brain. But she could no longer survive on her own. You know, she needed a feeding tube and all the rest. She was completely unconscious, and so she was in this situation where, the state of California diagnosed her as brain dead, which is, you know, for all intents and purposes, means that she was legally dead. I mean, that's how we define it. Her parents, for religious reasons, were not willing to accept that. And they found a lawyer who was able to challenge that. The state of California wasn't willing to, to revoke their death certificate. And so they actually flew Jahi to New Jersey, which has some different laws about death. And there she was cared for a few more years. There were you know, there were these questions about, you know, whether she might have regained any sort of awareness. She was certainly not communicative in any way, but there would be claims that she could, you know, squeeze her fingers, you know, on rare occasion that seemed to be in response to things. So it was this very ambiguous case. And, you know, her body was certainly alive in a sort of, you know, in a metabolic sense of the word, in the sense that her body continued to, you know, to take in oxygen and to make use of it, you know, through the food coming in through a feeding tube was being metabolized. She was growing. She actually started to go through puberty. So she did die of I believe it was liver failure, but. You know, so she really she you know illustrated the really difficult and sometimes very painful challenge that we face in and actually really trying to precisely draw a line between life and death, because and part of that is because it's difficult to define, and in, you know, the whole idea of brain death itself, as I write in the book, was actually something that came about sort of it's a very conscious decision among medical doctors, because they were develop they there were two technologies that were developing. One was the iron lung, which could keep people alive who otherwise would have just been completely dead. So if they couldn't breathe on their own, the iron lung could keep them going. And so there were these different sort of ventilators that followed from that. So you had these group of people who would be kept alive, usually not for very long, days, maybe weeks at most. So they were going to die in a sort of complete sense of the word. And meanwhile, the technologies involved in transplant, organ transplant, were developing. And, you know, transplant surgeons were saying, you know, these people are effectively dead. They're going to be, you know, everything is going to stop soon. And, you know, taking organs from cadavers, those organs aren't going to work as well in a living patient. So if we can declare people legally dead based on brain death, then we can take organs from these donors and give them to people who will then be able to live, you know, full lives for years. So that was just a, you know, that was a conversation that society had in the 1960s that led to a sort of to a consensus. That's a social arrangement. That's not some sort of precise scientific definition. And it's really important to understand, to not get those two things confused.
And is that still the consensus, despite the small research that is emerging that people can kind of recall to life or recall to death experiences after their heart stops for a long time and their brain flatlines for a period of time?
Yeah, it remains the legal standard, and you know the consensus hasn't changed much. The kinds of cases that you're talking about, these sometimes are called like near-death experiences. Those are very acute and short cases. You know, someone excuse me, you know, gets in a car accident or drowns or something, and you know their readings, you know, indicate that they seem to be dead, but then relatively quickly they come out of that. You know, in those cases, these people, you know, those people have not suffered, you know, huge amounts of brain damage. You know, when they quote unquote come back, you know, they're having conversations and, you know, talking about these experiences and having memories and so on and so forth. The cases of where people are declared brain dead, these are cases where there's just a huge, you know, a huge amount of the brain has been damaged, especially, you know, parts of the brain, the sort of the front of the brain, the frontal lobes, where that are help with consciousness, and when those are damaged beyond healing, like that's you're not going to expect anyone to come back from that. The thing is that there are these different aspects of life that we talk about, and one is metabolism and homeostasis, keeping the body stable. The body, Jay McMath's body temperature remained the same, maintained its own body temperature. Well, there's certain parts of the brain that are responsible for governing those sorts of things, like the hypothalamus, for example. And these are sort of little glands tucked out of the way. And so a person can experience like a devastating injury that destroys most of their brain, and yet there are little bits of the brain that are still intact that keep the heart beating and allow the lungs to function and maintain body temperature. Those are basic things. And so the legal definition of brain death, really implicit in it, it's really you could say, well, it's more of a consciousness death, because it doesn't matter if you have enough of your brain left to keep your heart beating. What matters is, are you ever going to be a conscious person again? And so there are two different aspects of this, and they're both fascinating to explore, and in any case, the legal definition of death still is, since the 1960s, hasn't really changed much. There's continues to be debate about it among philosophers and legal scholars, but the laws, at least in the United States, on the books haven't really changed.
Well, we've been talking about human life, but in Life's Edge, you look at life in many forms, including some forms most of us are likely to overlook. What's slime mold, and what interested you about it?
So slime mold is this, it's this cellular organism that's kind of related to amoebae, but it grows on forest floors, and you might walk past it and notice some brightly colored bulbs on the forest floor and not really know what you're looking at. They look a little bit like mushrooms, but they're just like weird bubbles with strange colors. And slime molds are just really remarkable because they, a cell will grow and stretch out in these sort of tendril-like extensions, and it'll become, visible to the naked eye. One cell can eventually become as big as, a bigger than a large book. what then happens is that this thing, it doesn't have a brain, but it does have this an awareness. It is, in the sense that it is able to sense its surroundings and make decisions. It can decide, like, which direction am I going to go to find food? And you can even put these things into mazes, and they will figure out their way through a maze. The scientists even talk about them doing a sort of a form of computation. And the fact that it doesn't have a brain or a nervous system, it's really just one cell, makes this capacity so fascinating. And I think that is actually a hallmark of all things that we would commonly call alive. And I don't know quite what the word is that you would use. Scientists sometimes use different words. I think intelligence is okay to use. Not the word intelligence in the sense of taking a standardized test to get into college, but definitely, an intelligence where an organism can get information about its surroundings and use that information to make decisions that benefit it.
You seem to have enjoyed the experience of working in a lab. as a science writer, is doing science the road not taken for you?
I certainly enjoy visiting people in labs or in their field. For the book, I went to a lab where they study slime molds, and I did an experiment with them. I was also interested in this thing I referred to, homeostasis, how animals and other organisms keep their interior in a sort of stable balance, even as the environment changes around them. And for that example, I was really interested in bats. So I went with some biologists who study bats that hibernate all winter long in an abandoned mine. It's a great part of my job to be able to go to these different places and meet with scientists studying very different things. If I were a scientist, if I studied slime molds, like every morning I would get up and I would head to the slime mold lab and I would study slime molds, and then I would write about papers about slime molds, and then I get up the next day and it would be more slime molds. And I don't think I have the temperament for that. So I'm glad that I found my way into this other way of learning about slime molds and bats and other things.
You certainly have variety. And let's use that variety and move from the lab to literature. What's the relationship between Mary Shelley's Frankenstein and the 19th century cultural struggle around evolution?
So Frankenstein is a wonderful piece of literature, even if you don't think about science. But if you do think about science and the history of science, it gets even more interesting, because Mary Shelley was, as young as she was when she started writing this book in her teens, she was an incredible observer of scientific trends and could think about what they meant about how we think about life. As I write in the book, people had been asking this basic question: what is life? Since the early 1700s, that's when you actually see it, in print. And there was this idea that there was some sort of vital force that distinguished living things from non-living things. But no one could say what that vital force was. It was just this mysterious thing that allowed organisms to move or to reproduce or to reach a goal, and anything that didn't do that didn't have the vital force. The discovery of electricity excited a lot of people, because it seemed like, oh, well, wait a minute, maybe this is it. Maybe this strange force that can make, a frog leg muscle contract, even if the leg has been cut off of a frog. Maybe this is it. And so Mary Shelley, Mary Wollstonecraft, and then Mary became Mary Shelley. She looked at these ideas and came up with it and sort of combined it with a nightmare that she had had, and thought about, well, is what science is trying to do here? Is it trying to sort of control life to the point that it would be able to create it on its own? And so that's how you end up with this monster that is that's assembled from the body parts from corpses with electricity. Obviously things go horribly wrong, so I find it really interesting, put in the context of all of the debates that were going on at the time about the subject of my book, what it means to be alive.
Artists have an insight that I think sometimes scientists struggle inch by inch to reach. Although the scientists do pretty well, and the discovery of DNA in the 20th century was a breakthrough in understanding life, Talk about how it led to the definition of life to be explored on other planets.
Our understanding of life on Earth developed a lot, obviously from the early 19th century when Mary Shelley was writing to the 20th century. You have a few key discoveries. You have the discovery that of cells, that life as we know it exists in cells. So there are these boundaries, and that it holds in chemicals that can react with each other. And then another important discovery is of DNA as being the molecule that encodes information for making those molecules and is also able to be passed down, whether it's a cell dividing in two and passing it down to the two new cells, or an animal or a plant passing it down to its descendants. And for all the variety of life on Earth, whether it's slime molds or people or elephants or what have you, cells, DNA, that's pretty much standard. And that's probably because animals and plants and fungi and so on all descend from a common ancestor. So, people have wondered, well, is there life on other planets? They've wondered that for quite a long time. And that whole asking of that question has really turned into a science of its own, astrobiology. And there is a big challenge there of what does it mean to go to another planet and find something and say, this is life? Like, how are we going to know? What a lot of astrobiologists are focused on as sort of a preliminary attempt at that is to look for life as we know it. Look at life as it is on Earth. Look for life that is made of cells, maybe has, DNA or something a lot like DNA, and just sort of say, like, well, what would we expect to see on a planet that had DNA-based cellular life as opposed to just nothing like that? We're not yet at the point where there are real life detectors going around to Mars or the moons of Saturn to really nail that. But there's a debate, an ongoing debate, about whether this is actually a good idea because it's practical, or it's a bad idea because it's excluding other possibilities that life could take. It's a good debate to have. If there isn't kind of a sustained focus on looking for life on other planets, then it's going to be kind of a moot point. We won't know until we get there.
And of course, we risk the Frankenstein message that we find a life form and it's not good for us.
It's hard to know what we would find if we found life. There are all sorts of things that you can imagine, and there might be things that we can't imagine. where we sit on Earth, in the food web, we have started to get used to not really being that worried about other life forms. Shark attacks are very rare. Sharks are amazing predators in their food web, but we humans, we don't have to worry about that. A lot of the big predators are near extinction because of us. Wolves and lions and so on are having a difficult time of it. Would there be a sort of a super predator on another planet? Who knows? We haven't seen no evidence of that yet. Then on the very small scale, there are we still obviously have reason to be wary of microbes, of bacteria and viruses, of fungi. You know, they still claim many lives today. We certainly, like, you know, in many countries, deaths from infectious diseases are very low now. But, you know, if you encounter something that can infect you on another planet, that could be just an entirely new battle that we are just not ready for. And this is, again, has been a debate for a long time about whether this represents a risk that we just don't want to take. Even, you know, bringing back samples from other planets, you know, astrobiologists have gone through a lot of research about how to make sure that you can deliver material back from, say, Mars safely. If there is some sort of microbe on Mars, you don't want to bring it back to Earth and start, you know, some type of bizarre outbreak. And so there are all sorts of measures in place. You know, they're actually called planetary precaution. It goes both ways, though, because, you know, just as we wouldn't want to contaminate Earth with something from Mars or somewhere else, we also don't want to contaminate Mars with our microbes. And that turns out to be very difficult because, you know, life on Earth, at least, some species at least, are very hardy, you know, bacteria that can form spores. You can bake them at incredible temperatures and they just will not die. And so there has been some concern that especially the early missions to Mars may have seeded Mars with Earth life, which complicate things. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is the sort of parallel debate about whether there's intelligent life in the universe and, you know, the danger that would pose. And that's, you know, the subject of plenty of science fiction movies. The thinking being that, you know, there could be some intelligent form of life out there that looks at us the way that, you know, we look at ants. And, you know, you can't really, you know, you can't rule out the existence of them. You know, certainly we haven't heard from them. And I, despite all the claims about UFOs, I don't see much reason to accept. I mean, we haven't actually like had clear, you know, evidence that they've arrived to say hello. That silence, you know, sometimes scientists refer to that as the great silence. And, you know, the fact that we have not detected intelligent life elsewhere in the universe really does raise some serious questions about maybe the odds of intelligent life are much lower than we had anticipated. Maybe we are much rarer than we appreciated.
Well, you defined intelligence in a slime mold, so perhaps there is still a possibility, but we're still discovering new life forms on this planet. What are your thoughts about the life forms that were found in 2011 deep in the Dead Sea, which is apparently not dead?
Well, you know, extreme environments like the depths of the Dead Sea, you know, they would have been traditionally thought to be too harsh for living things to survive in. It has become abundantly clear in recent decades that microbes in particular can evolve into incredibly rugged forms. They can survive in places, you know, with very extreme temperatures, very cold, very hot. They can survive in places where it doesn't seem like there's really any nutrients to be had, but they can, you know, scrape a living by. There's a sort of an underground lake in Antarctica. You have to drill miles down through the ice to get to this lake called Lake Vostok. And there are bacteria and viruses, a whole ecosystem there. There's even, if you go into, when scientists actually like go down into mines or drill deep into rock, they will find bacteria, other microbes, viruses there as well. Sometimes they are actually getting their energy from the radioactivity in the rocks around them. So the more that scientists go to these extreme environments, the more species they find, and that's one of the really exciting things about biology these days is that the diversity of life, especially the diversity of microscopic life, far exceeds what anyone had guessed, 50 or 100 years ago.
It is really fascinating. Finally, after writing the book, what do you think defines life?
As people will see in the book, there are hundreds of definitions of life that scientists have put forward, overlapping definitions, but still definitions that do not line up with each other. And I don't see scientists who spend their time studying life every day really converging yet. It's not like they're settling on one definition and it's all set. The debates continue. And so I don't see actually like any reason to say, aha, this is it. I have found the definition of life. I think it's that disagreement that is so fascinating to me. And it might actually be telling us something. And as I talk about in the book, you know, there are philosophers who are challenging scientists, saying, why do you keep looking for a definition? Is that really the best thing to do? You know, we clearly don't understand life very well. That's clear. But is it the best thing to try to come up with a definition? What about a theory? A theory of life, a theory that could explain life as a property of matter. That could be in the same way that, you know, scientists, you know, discovered superconductivity over a century ago, a very strange property of certain kinds of metals. When you got them very cold, they just lost their resistance. And no one could explain it. It was just this weird thing. And so trying to define superconductivity at that point would have been silly. And so what needed to happen was there needed to be like broad basic work on properties of matter. And eventually you could see how under certain conditions, certain ways in which electrons moved around inside of a substance would lead to superconductivity. So that's more of a theory. So I can't give you a definition. I can't give you a theory either, but maybe a theory is the direction we should go in.
The book is Life's Edge, The Search for What It Means to Be Alive. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me today, Carl.
Thank you.
And thanks to our researcher, Bela Pasikoff.